This weekend starts right after this.
Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
Unprecedented voter surge. I'm Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koschenka. Thanks for spending some time with us. Here's what's coming up this hour.
There were areas of the country where voter turnout for the midterms exceeded turnout for the presidential election. We'll identify the hot spots.
Newest need for college athletic departments, psychologists for student athletes.
A popular video on Facebook features two strangers who shared a meal at McDonald's. Hear how they encountered each other.
And on the entertainment front, TV is finding captive audiences featuring programs with older actors.
They're really finding out that on broadcast networks especially, I think they're becoming a lot more realistic about the audience and how the audience has shifted. I mean, for one, you know, the young people have abandoned network TV in a lot of ways.
Wall Street Journal reporter John Jurgensen on TV having a senior moment. He's here in about 20 minutes. Far fewer voters participate in midterms than in presidential elections, but interest in this year's races was so high that vote tallies in some places hit or exceeded presidential levels. More from Wall Street Journal reporter and editor Aaron Zitner, who's been poring over some new data. Aaron, give us some takeaways.
So for the first time, more than 100 million ballots were cast in a midterm election. We might get up as high as 116 million ballots. As turnout goes, which is the share of eligible voters who come out to vote, we also hit the highest mark probably since 1914. Records get a little sketchy, you know, the further back you go. The most recent high was in 1966, you know, which was civil rights movement era. The protests against the Vietnam War were just coming together. That had been the high for the share of eligible voters who turned out. We've exceeded that, we know, even before all the votes are counted. How high was it? It was so high this year that in a number of places, the total number of votes cast in this year's midterm exceeded the number that were cast in the last cycle's presidential election, the 2016 election. Midterm turnout rarely touches presidential levels.
And the reason for this is what?
Well, you know, you could say it in two words. President Trump, he's just motivated people on both sides of the aisle. We saw in Wall Street Journal, NBC News polling before the election that there was record interest in voting. And in the surveys done of people who actually voted, a very large share said that President Trump figured into their choice of candidates on Election Day.
How about these pockets where there were really big surges, like you point out in a number of counties in Montana, another jump around Austin, Texas. What about those?
Yeah, we have a really nifty map up online by my colleague Brian McGill that shows in pretty vivid colors where, by county, where more votes came in this year than in the presidential election in 2016. The first place that jumps out to me is in Montana. And Montana doesn't have a lot of people, but President Trump went there four times to try to elect a Republican in the Senate race there, and he failed. John Tester, the Democrat, held on to his seat, but to get four presidential visits during an election year in a state like that is extraordinary. And sure enough, in about 15 of the 50-some counties in Montana, turnout exceeded presidential year levels. Now, the thing is, when you look at who won those counties, you can see that it wasn't all Republican turnout. President Trump, the numbers suggest, turned out as many Democrats as Republicans in those places, and that helped John Tester hang on. In fact, he surpassed 50% of the vote in the state, which I don't think he did 6 years ago in his prior election. And as you mentioned, you look around Texas, around Austin, and around the urban areas, very high turnout, probably driven by Beto O'Rourke, who fell 3 points, 2.5 points shy of winning there. But you can see which communities are responsible for what was an unusually close Senate race.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal editor and reporter Aaron Zitner about his piece entitled Voter Turnout Hit Records This Year. What does this all mean for, say, 2020, with President Trump apparently having an outsized effect on so many areas?
Oh, boy. I mean, high turnout in a number of states this year helped Republicans. It wasn't all Democratic surge. We saw that in a place like Georgia, where there was high turnout across the state. I'd say the overall lesson is that President Trump is the reality TV president. He's a dominating presence. He still, 2 years into his tenure, just dominates the airwaves. He takes up a lot of mind share, a lot of bandwidth in the public discourse, and he's a highly polarizing figure. And that has energized the electorate like we haven't seen in decades. And for 2020, I think it just suggests that turnout is going to continue to be high. People are very engaged right now. Politics in Washington has become a feature of our daily lives. Yeah. It's hard to escape it, and people are going to stay engaged.
If you're, say, a congressional candidate thinking of running for office, or perhaps you're running for re-election in 2020, and you're looking at the maps, say, in your story, can you take away anything from that? Are there lessons about campaigning here?
Remember, the Senate turns over every 6 years. So if you are a senator and you run first in a year like this year, where there isn't a presidential election, next time you'll run during a presidential election. So the set of senators running in 2020 is going to be in different geographies than this year.
Yeah.
The Senate map looks much less disadvantageous, more advantageous, I guess is the better way to put it, for Democrats next time around than this time. They only have a couple of seats that are up, maybe even only one, in states that Trump won.
Thanks, Aaron. Wall Street Journal reporter and editor Aaron Zitner. 13 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. November is American Diabetes Awareness Month. For those who've been diagnosed, diabetes impacts nearly every decision they make daily, from what to eat, what to wear, what to do, and other decisions about how they'll take care of themselves. Yet the burden of diabetes management is often misunderstood. Early detection and treatment can decrease the risk of developing the complications of diabetes. More from Tracy Brown, CEO of the American Diabetes Association, and their new awareness campaign about everyday reality. Tracy, tell us about the growth of diabetes.
The growth is, it is quite startling, Gordon. Diabetes is the biggest health epidemic of our time right now. There are over 30 million Americans living with diabetes, and there are over 84 million Americans living with prediabetes, and 90% of them, i.e. 75 million people, are walking around with prediabetes and don't even know it. So this is a big deal.
Boy, is that the unwillingness to say to go to the doctor, or is it misdiagnoses? Like, what's happening here with that?
I think there are a number of things, Gordon, contributing to this. So one is diabetes is considered to be the silent or invisible killer, i.e. more and more people are living with this disease, and a lot don't even know it because people don't talk about it.
Okay.
Gordon,
yeah.
One. Two, there's a lot of stigma associated with having diabetes. People automatically assume that if you're living with diabetes, you have somehow done that to yourself, like that you caused yourself to get diabetes. So therefore, people don't talk about it because of this stigma. That's a huge miseducation. And two, people assume, because again, the lack of knowledge, that if you have diabetes, that, you know, kind of your life is over, your world is over, like you can't eat all of the things that you used to eat. And so therefore, people don't talk about it. So there's a lot of complexity wrapped up into this. And so that's what Diabetes Month is about, is really trying to ignite a national conversation to drive the sense of urgency and awareness around this disease.
How do you do that? I mean, the numbers are astonishing, and they keep growing. I feel like any message that's put out there is not being received.
Yeah, so that is part of what we want to do. I believe, and we at the American Diabetes Association believe that knowledge is power, and if you actually start talking about this and helping educating people on just the facts alone, that will help. But it starts, I think, Gordon, with knowing your numbers. So I'm encouraging every single person to take the risk test. It's a very simple test that is on our website. You answer a few questions. It will help you understand if you're at risk for diabetes.
Okay.
That will allow you to actually start to take some action and empower you to do something. That website is diabetes.org/everydayreality. So it starts there. Two, Gordon, I want people to know the facts, just as we have been talking today. Listen, every 6.5 minutes, someone is dying from diabetes or its complications. That is 228 people per day.
We're speaking with Tracy Brown. She's the CEO of the American Diabetes Association, talking about American Diabetes Month. This year's theme is Everyday Reality. What's the percentage of people, say, who could avoid diabetes if they, I don't know, tackled things properly before the early signs had set in?
You know, there are things that you can actually do to help manage the disease. But you have to have the gene. There are things that trigger off the gene. There's type 1 and type 2. Type 1, your pancreas doesn't produce insulin at all, so you will be dependent on insulin for your life. For type 2, your pancreas doesn't produce enough insulin. And so you can be on insulin, you can be on pill forms of medication, and you can manage.
Thanks, Tracy. Tracy Brown, CEO of the American Diabetes Association. By the way, in 2017, the total cost of diagnosed diabetes in the U.S., according to one estimate, was $327 billion. 22 minutes now after the hour. On This Weekend, glad you're with us. There's a deepening niche on TV about seniors. The latest entry, The Kaminsky Method, which is now out on Netflix. More from This Weekend's Jennifer Koschenka.
TV is having a senior moment. All of a sudden, old folks are starring in numerous sitcoms. John Jurgensen of The Wall Street Journal has this story. John, what are some of the shows that we're talking about?
Well, the one we looked at the most is a new one coming up called The Kaminsky Method that stars two guys, Hollywood veterans, who are both getting up there in years. Alan Arkin, who's 84, and Michael Douglas, who's 74. But they're not alone. Grace and Frankie is another one with Hollywood veterans starring Lily Tomlin, Jane Fonda. That's also on Netflix. And those are maybe a little more expected because they're on Netflix, which is not a, you know, doesn't need advertising to support itself. But you see this on broadcast networks, too, now, where some of the shows are featuring a lot older characters than you ever would have probably seen in years before. You know, Golden Girls not included.
You talk about the Netflix versus broadcast TV. Are these shows popular on TV, and what kind of advertisers are supporting them?
They're really finding out that on broadcast networks especially, I think they're becoming a lot more realistic about the audience and how the audience has shifted. I mean, for one, you know, the young people have abandoned network TV in a lot of ways. You know, not for all shows, but for a lot of the shows and a lot of networks, that's really the case. Especially if you know which nights you're programming to. So, for example, the show The Cool Kids on Fox, which stars Vicki Lawrence and Martin Mull and a couple other folks in their 60s and 70s, it's a Friday night TV show, and that really was done by design because they know that young people are not at home watching TV on Friday nights. So in some ways, it was kind of targeted programming because they know that these shows might have an appeal to older viewers or families who might want to see kind of a different scenario on their TV on Friday nights. So that came down to pretty just strategic and smart programming.
John, are the ads very targeted as well?
I think what you're seeing is more, you know, it's not necessarily they're targeting to an older audience, but what you're seeing is probably, you know, they charge a little less for advertising on a Friday night. And, you know, it's some of your general stuff that you would see on most networks, you know, your car commercials, your drug commercials, things like that. So, I mean, anywhere you look on broadcast TV today, too, you can almost see, you know, some ads for products deemed like somewhat older target audience.
We're speaking with John Jurgensen of the Wall Street Journal. John, are all these shows that have a lot of seniors in them sitcoms, or are there some dramas?
Oh, that's actually a really good question. They mostly tend to be comedies, and I'm actually not really sure why that is. I think a lot of it has to do with, you know, just the format that seems to be working right now. You know, you can keep, if you do have some jokes about aging, you can keep them kind of lighthearted, and, you know, you're not going into sort of, like, darker or depressing stuff. You know, but there are some series on TV that have, like, older leads. You know, CBS has a whole lineup of shows, and CBS, of course, is a network that has a much older audience than other networks. They have, you know, leading men and women who are mature in their ages and getting into their senior ages. You know, Tom Selleck, for example, is one of the main stars on the show Blue Bloods and has been for years. So, yeah, you do have some dramas. I think in those cases, the dramas would just have, you know, have these kind of respectable, kind of august characters who are in lead roles, but not necessarily dwelling on their age, whereas the comedies allow them a little more room to have some fun with that idea and poke fun at themselves.
John, you touched on it earlier. How do you write jokes that aren't just caricatures of older people and relying on the same old stuff about aging and loss and we don't look so good anymore?
Yeah, I mean, it's a real issue. And when I spoke to the producer of The Cool Kids, you know, he said that at first when he heard about the idea, he wasn't interested. He thought, you know, those are just kind of lazy jokes about, you know, characters in a retirement home and, you know, making fun of the fact that they can't get up and, you know, the, you know, Viagra jokes and things like that.
Thanks, John. Wall Street Journal entertainment reporter John Jurgensen with this weekend's Jennifer Koshenka. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Long known as a world leader in the automotive industry, Michigan is also a leader in advanced manufacturing, cybersecurity, agribusiness, and aerospace. In fact, CNBC rates Michigan as the most improved state for business. To learn more, visit MichiganBusiness.org. Glad you could spend part of your weekend with us. Gordon Deal with Jennifer Koshenka coming up this half hour, debating the so-called FIRE movement for retirement. Also, big names building pop-up stores this holiday season. And the strangers at McDonald's who sit down to share a meal and unexpectedly go viral. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. College students in general are reporting more depression and anxiety than ever. Varsity athletes cope with those issues while under a spotlight and balancing studies with time-intensive training. Alongside weight rooms and nutrition programs, mental health services are now growing into indispensable parts of major college athletic departments. It's a story by Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. Rachel, what are you hearing?
Well, as we know, a lot of things in college athletic departments have become sort of required, like, you know, fancy weight rooms and nutrition programs, things like that. And increasingly, one of the things that's become really compulsory for college athletic departments is in-house psychological services. And there are a number of reasons for this, mainly because, as some people know, nationwide, more college students generally have issues like depression and anxiety, and that certainly is true for college athletes as well.
Have the problems always been there and gone unaddressed, or are we, suddenly seeing new health concerns here?
That's a good question. I think it's a combination of things. I think that the stigma is decreasing to asking for help. So there are more college students and college athletes asking for help with a variety of mental health issues. But also, the causes are debated, I think that there are more problems. It's a fairly stressful world we live in. There is some discussion about other contributing factors. But in addition to that, college athletes, of course, are dealing with the stresses of college while also under the spotlight of, in some cases, you know, a large national TV audience.
Yeah.
And so that can certainly weigh more heavily both in dealing with the issues from day to day and also in seeking help for them.
Are there some schools that appear to be out in front on this?
Yeah, well, University of Southern California has had a psychologist on staff for 20 years, And the staff is now several members. And she said that about half of USC's athletes on a regular basis, or at least in a given year, have seen a psychologist one-on-one. And that's for a range of issues. Sometimes it's sports performance. You know, maybe they have some anxiety or some feelings during a game or a contest that they want some help dealing with. In other cases, it's just dealing with the stresses of being an athlete or just, you know, stresses of life.
Yeah.
And yet other cases, you know, there are some student athletes, just like there are college students with, you know, serious mental health issues, suicidal thoughts, things like that. And certainly those college athletic departments want to address immediately.
We're speaking with Wall Street Journal sports reporter Rachel Bachman. Her piece is called College Sports' Newest Need, Psychologists. All right, so you referenced Southern Cal having one on staff for 20 years, which made me think, okay, you've got one on staff. Does that mean that they're accessible, helpful, you know, beneficial?
Yeah, I think that's another battle that you're talking about in terms of, you know, getting athletes to ask for help and to come and see psychologists. University of Oklahoma did something interesting just recently. They added another office for their department of psychology within the athletic department that was close to the trainer's office, the athletic trainer's office where people go to get their ankles taped, things like that. And the reason they did that is so that athletes wouldn't feel like they were standing out by going, you know, maybe to another building to see a counselor.
Oh, wow.
They could just walk down the hall like they were going to get their ankles taped, but go into another room and see a counselor instead of, you know, seeking kind of their regular physical medical treatment. So there are things that some schools are doing to make it easier for athletes to ask for help and to see a counselor regularly without being conspicuous.
Yeah. You know, you referenced the one student athlete in your story who I, you know, wound up getting help sort of indirectly and then directly, right? He was texting his friend or his girlfriend who was sitting like right next to him on the couch, and he couldn't express his feelings, so he's just texting her, and she
yeah.
was the one who sort of said, let's do something, right?
Yeah, that's right. That was a former cross-country runner at Indiana University who, you know, had a lot of injury issues and you know, really stressful things going on in his life, and started to feel suicidal thoughts. And so he initially confided in his girlfriend, as you said, via text message, sitting next to her on the couch, because it was so difficult to voice those words. And she encouraged him to get professional help. As it turned out, Indiana, this is a couple of years ago, had just hired a psychologist within the athletic department to deal with just these issues, among others. And so this athlete found her and started to visit with her weekly and, you know, got the help he needed.
Thanks, Rachel. Wall Street Journal reporter Rachel Bachman. It is 20 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for spending time with us. What could possibly be wrong with saving like crazy so you can retire early? That's the notion behind the financial independence / retire early, or FIRE movement, as it's known. Lately, personal finance expert Jonathan Clemens says he's read a lot of carping about FIRE, both in articles and in the emails he gets. He's the founder and editor at HumbleDollar.com. Jonathan, explain this movement.
The FIRE movement has really taken hold in the last couple of years. You know, we've seen more and more people boasting about how they've managed to retire in their 40s, or even in their 30s. Often these are people who have had fairly high-paying careers, either in the tech industry or perhaps as a physician. They saved massive amounts of money in a relatively brief period, and then they quit. And this has created a lot of controversy out there. People have, you know, questioned whether the FIRE devotees really have a role model for the rest of us, whether they're actually too good delaying gratification.
Yeah.
There's also been questions about whether these people really are truly retired. A lot of the FIRE devotees actually make money from blogging and writing books, or they might have a spouse who's still working and pulling in an income.
Oh, okay.
So maybe they aren't really living off the savings that they accumulated during their very brief working careers.
And you point out, too, and I thought this was a good point, maybe because I'm guilty or perhaps a devotee of it, and that is, like, you got to live a little bit. So you point out, like, sometimes the frugality is just excessive.
Right. I mean, obviously, for most Americans, the problem runs in the opposite direction. Most of us spend way too much and save way too little, and that's a big problem. But arguably, some of the FIRE devotees are going in the opposite direction. and making an equally bad mistake. They're saving way too much and, in a sense, postponing all joy. Now, I should add, Gordon, I mean, these are the complaints that I hear.
Yeah.
I don't buy into them 100%. Frankly, I see a lot to admire in the FIRE movement, and I think that, to a degree, they really are a model for the rest of us. The idea that you save a lot of money in your 20s and 30s and get yourself in great financial shape early on, that's something that all of us should strive to do, and that many people make a mistake by spending way too much early in their career.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, also founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. And we're talking about the FIRE movement. That's the acronym for Financial Independence Retire Early. A lot of this, too, I guess, comes down to your personal wishes. I mean, your financial desires may be much different from somebody else's. It's not fair to throw everybody in the same bucket.
No, that's absolutely true. I would say that one of the key things that you need to figure out is when during your working career do you want to cut yourself some slack.
Yeah.
And let me explain what I mean by that. You know, as a society, we tend to say to, you know, young adults in their 20s, this is the time in your life when you should pursue your passions. So it's okay if you go off and, you know, try to start a rock and roll band or be an actor on Broadway or become an artist or travel the world, whatever it is. That is what we as a society often say. And yet the fact is, you know, people in their 20s are often very happy in the work world. It's new and exciting. They find their jobs, you know, interesting. They're really, you know, the work world is pretty enthralling. By contrast, when you get to my age, when you're in your 50s, the work world is not enthralling. You know, if you have to go to another meeting and listen to another tedious PowerPoint presentation, you're going to go out back and blow out your brains. I would argue that for a lot of people, they'd be much better off making dollars in their 20s and pursuing passions in their 50s.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, personal finance expert, again, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It's 13 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Hey, glad you're with us. Time now for a business update, and it's brought to you by the Michigan Economic Development Corporation. When a state ranks among the top 10 in the country for major new and expanded facilities, that's pure growth. When it's tops for four straight years, that's pure Michigan. Contact MichiganBusiness.org. Pop-ups are all the rage this holiday season, from Facebook hosting its first pop-ups in Macy's to furniture website Wayfair carving out space in malls. Both budding and longtime brands are opening temporary shops to tap into the holiday shopping rush. Here's what's trending from USA Today national business correspondent Charisse Jones. Charisse, what's up?
Holiday seasons are always a time for pop-ups, but now it's actually something you're seeing year-round. And so you've got all of these different brands like Build-A-Bear, stores like Wayfair, even Facebook that are getting in on this pop-up trend. And it really fills a lot of different purposes. If you're an online company, it gives you a chance to have a physical footprint without spending a fortune, you know, renting property for a long time. If you're an old-time retailer, you get the chance to test a market or test a mall without the investment. And it also fills a lot of vacancies in these malls. And so it's really a win-win for a lot of different players.
You know, a place like Build-A-Bear, I consider a shop that's already in a mall. Why would they need a pop-up?
Well, you know, I think it's a way to, again, get access to more customers without having to invest in the property. I mean, it takes a lot of money to, you know, lease a building or to buy something.
And then Wayfair, at least to me, correct me if I'm wrong, seems kind of the opposite, like more of an online presence than a physical one, and yet here they are with a pop-up.
Exactly. I mean, they're an example of a company that wants to be able to interact with customers in a way that they can't because they are an online company. So being in a couple of malls this holiday season and having people in person talk about how to decorate their homes, et cetera, you know, kind of gives them a touch point with their actual customers, and it gives them a chance to actually reach people who may not be familiar with them. So again, they're getting that access without a huge financial investment.
We're speaking with Charisse Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. Her piece is called Facebook, Wayfair, and Build-A-Bear among those with pop-ups this holiday season. All right, so we understand Wayfair selling perhaps home goods and Build-A-Bear selling stuffed animals. Along comes Facebook, right, which has an interesting partnership with Macy's. Explain this.
Yeah, so Facebook has got a small business pop-up in 9 Macy's stores, including the flagship Herald Square in Manhattan. And basically, it's giving exposure to these small companies and brands that you may not have heard of. And it really works out for Macy's because it makes them kind of hip, right? It makes them a destination. They've got this alliance with Facebook, which has, you know, 1 billion followers. They're getting these new brands into their space, and so that attracts customers.
Cherise Jones, national business correspondent at USA Today. 6 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for joining us. An unlikely pair who shared a meal at a McDonald's in Indiana has gone viral. The two strangers caught the attention of another customer named Amanda Kraft, who was touched by the moment. Ms. Kraft from Noblesville was dining at the fast food chain with her colleagues when she spotted an older woman, known only as Jan, ask a young man named Eric Harrelson if she could join him at his table. Without hesitation, the 28-year-old Mr. Harrelson said, of course. The Facebook post by Ms. Kraft included a photo of the two, one who's black, the other who's white. Ms. Kraft said they fell into an easy chat. Mr. Harrelson told ABC News that Jan approached him when she was eating breakfast not long after she tried having a conversation with a group of teenagers at the restaurant. He said the two talked for 45 minutes, then exchanged numbers. He later called her to let her know that they'd gone viral. As one commenter said, different races, different cultures, different genders, different ages. How inspirational. For Jennifer Koshenka, I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.